North. 11. Flying to Amman. As I was finishing my degree at the University of Toronto, I began reading more about Palestine, and my desire to return to my ancestral home got stronger. It was a call to me, like the Adhan. I wanted to go to Palestine and get to know more about my people firsthand. I wanted to know more about my cultural heritage and the suffering of my people. I had saved up a little money, and I finally made a conscious decision. "I'm going to return to Palestine," I told my friends and family. "I can take care of myself, and I can be a bridge between people, using my fluency in Arabic and English. I will document it somehow." "But you are not a journalist." "No, but there are ways to do this online." Towards the middle of September 2000, I boarded a plane heading to France for the first leg of my journey. I was aware of the many Arab and Muslim brothers and sisters with me on the flight, but I didn't feel like talking to them. I wanted to be in my own little world, but the close quarters on an airplane don't always allow it. The Texan sitting beside me was planning to tour Eastern Europe, Russia, and the Middle East, and I heard about it at length. He didn't ask me about my travel plans, but I'd given myself a project called Compare Life as a Palestinian Canadian in Canada to Life as a Canadian Palestinian in Palestine. Uncle Yazan had challenged me to write about the suffering of Palestinians in the occupied territories. In some ways, I was going to a place where I belonged, yet my impressions, beyond being in Jordan for 3 years as a child, had been formed mainly by the Western media. I had begun to understand the art of media spin. The camera shot that says 1,000 words, often none of them good. The mind that arrives at a conflict scene already made up. The pro-Israeli bias in the media that showed Israelis looking civilized and Palestinians looking angry, yelling with scarves tied around their heads and faces, to give the impression that most Palestinians would bomb people in public places and kill themselves doing it. I wanted to go where I could dig behind those biased reports. My parents and friends weren't entirely on board with my plans. "You want to go to the Middle East now? Look at what you're getting into. What if you find yourself in the middle of a war? Mwafa, you are going at such a sensitive time when so many things could happen. I don't think it's wise. If you must go, go for a quick visit and come home." "It will always be sensitive there," I replied. "I may never have this chance again." For months, Palestinian people had been preparing for large-scale protests against the Israeli Defense Forces if the peace talks floundered. The Israelis had certainly been doing the same and had been chasing the pump, as bodybuilders say, by stocking up on billions of dollars worth of military equipment given to them by the United States. My dad said he would rather I stayed home and worked. He was afraid for me, and he was thinking like most fathers would. If your kids have the opportunity, they should work, make money, get married, have kids, carve out a future. But he also knew I had to do this. It wasn't just that I was the firstborn, the oldest son, and had his name as my middle name. I was also at the age and time of my life when this trip was most possible. I had finished my degree and was thinking about grad school and settling down in a few years' time. The time for Palestine was now. My plan was to go to Al-Quds, the capital of Palestine, known in the West as Jerusalem, and find an inexpensive hostel there. My ultimate goal was to offer the Isha, the daily nighttime prayer, at Al-Masjid Al-Aqsa, which was located on the Haram Esh-Sharif, the Temple Mount. As the plane crossed the Atlantic Ocean towards the Middle East, I could feel myself reaching into the past, becoming an extension of my ancestors. As I was wrapping up my graduate studies in Toronto, I felt a strong urge to study Arabic and religion, and for me that also meant connecting with my cultural and political heritage. There was no better place to do that than in Palestine, I'd reasoned, and so here I was on my way to take courses in Islamic studies and Arabic at the Islamic University of Gaza. Though I'd lived in Jordan as a child for 3 years, had heard Arabic at home constantly, and could speak it at the mosque, it was not enough for me. I also wanted to learn more about Islam at Al-Aqsa, and the time felt right. The Camp David summit had taken place in July 2000 with U.S. President Bill Clinton, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat meeting in hopes of negotiating a peace settlement. During those meetings, 4 major items became 4 big obstacles. Territory/borders, Jerusalem and the Haram es-Sharif, refugees and the right of return, and Israeli security concerns. The photos of the 3 leaders standing around in casual clothes in the woodland like old friends did not tell the whole story. In the end, the Camp David summit of 2000 was a failure, just as the Oslo conference of 1993 and the Camp David summit of 1978 had been, and other summits before, between, and after. The problem was always the same. The most that the Israelis were willing to give did not meet the least that the Palestinians were asking for. 2 things the Palestinians wanted were a reversion to the lines of 1967, the year of the Israeli-Arab Six-Day War, and recognition of the right of return for Palestinian refugees. Bill Clinton tried floating a bridging proposal, which would result in additional flexibility on territory, and some EU observers reported that Israel would accept the idea of East Jerusalem as the capital of a Palestinian state. I held to a youthful optimism that voices of passion and reason would prevail and that matters would be resolved. I needed to assess the situation with my own eyes. It was easy to be critical in a classroom on the other side of the world, but in the end, being on the street in Palestine would give me the best understanding of the situation. If the peace talks failed, I knew I would likely be traveling into a large-scale conflict. People living in impoverished camps would never see the Palestine that was taken from them. The new regime would suppress them further, and the Palestinian economy would continue to decline, and Palestinians would not take that suppression lying down. At the time I arrived in Jerusalem, the Waqf, the Islamic Religious Endowment, was conducting extensive construction on the Masjid al-Aqsa. Muslims call it the Noble Sanctuary, Bayt ul-Muqaddas. It marks the location of Muhammad's arrival in Jerusalem and his ascent to heaven, and is the 3rd holiest site in Islam after Mecca and Medina. The same site is considered so holy by Jews, who call it Har HaBayit, the Mount of the House of God, that they will not walk there. Because of its significance for both Judaism and Islam, sovereignty over the Haram es-Sharif is a major point of contention. Both Israel and the Palestinian Authority claim sovereignty over it, and it lies at the center of the ongoing Arab-Israeli conflict, both geographically and emotionally. One of the people I connected with before I left Toronto was journalist and consultant Mark Brzozinski. The tagline for his website is "News, Views, and Analysis Governments, Lobbies, and Associated Interest Groups Don't Want You to Know." Mark's perspectives amazed me and reminded me to get to know Jews as well as Arabs in the Middle East. The challenge might be finding ordinary Jews to talk to as opposed to people who were part of the powerful Israeli elite. With degrees in international affairs and law from Princeton and New York University, Mark has written and spoken for many years about world affairs, U.S. foreign policy, the Middle East, the underlying realities of policymaking in Washington, and U.S.-Israeli relations. When I contacted him in 2000, he was also producer and host of the weekly TV program Mideast Realities. He has traveled to over 45 countries and has been the official guest of many organizations, such as the PLO, and governments, including those of Egypt, Libya, Sudan, and Saudi Arabia. Until the Jewish Committee on the Middle East had to end its activities in 1994, Mark was chair of this group, the first American Jewish organization to call for a fully sovereign and independent Palestinian state. JCOME's statement of principles was published in more than 50 mainstream newspapers and magazines, including the New York Review of Books. It's difficult for an Arab cause to get fair mainstream coverage, so this was a big deal. It's the kind of thing that gives you great hope for even the possibility of understanding and resolution, I wrote in my journal at the time. I had always thought that all or most Jews hated Arabs and Muslims because Israel had stolen our land and displaced our people. It's true that my father had a Jewish friend or two, and my uncle Faisal had worked with an Edmonton rabbi as part of the outreach work in their respective communities of faith until the Israeli war in Lebanon caused a disagreement between them. If Mark Brzozinski had been an Arab or Muslim criticizing his own people, he would have been ostracized from the community, as I suspected he had been from his own Jewish community. But here was a person who wanted to help and make a difference, despite that cost. Mark suggested I read David Fromkin's A Peace to End All Peace, The Fall of the Ottoman Empire and the Creation of the Modern Middle East. Fromkin's book, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, looks at how the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire during World War I led to great changes in the Middle East as it was carved out by the Allies. He explores the role played by European powers in creating the Middle East as it is today, with the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the signing of the Balfour Declaration, which promised land for Jewish people in historic Palestine. That signaled the beginning of ongoing Arab-Israeli conflicts and hostilities and remains a major source of dissent. This context and this history should have been clear indicators of what would happen after the current peace process had run its course. I was heading into a volatile environment without a full understanding of the history. I would catch up quickly. I could feel my body tense up as I listened to Ben, the American seated next to me on the second leg of my flight to Israel, talk about the Middle East. All empires seek influence, he said, so American intervention in world politics is only normal. Think objectively. As if that made it all right that Palestine's borders were redrawn after World War II, that Israel was granted Palestinian land, and that the Palestinians became refugees in the aftermath of what had happened to European Jews. Something was really wrong. So many of the current European settler Jews had little connection with citizens of Israel, and there were a few Jewish people who were not Zionists, who did not approve of the creation of a state at the expense of indigenous people. But people like Ben think we should be objective. It's the kind of thing that could drive a Muslim to drink, I thought as the flight attendant rolled the cart by my seat. When I had fought back in school, people who saw me might have thought, how typical. They start young, troublemakers, aggressive and uncivilized. Yet being quiet and invisible doesn't work either. What is he planning? What is he plotting, skulking around like that? Why doesn't he talk to us and reassure us if he's not a terrorist in training? Whether out in the open as an Arab or trying not to be openly Arab, we could never do the right thing. There is no place to go. I was going to leave all that behind for a few months and see what kind of person I was in Palestine. I tried not to think of my mother worrying about me and talking endlessly to all her friends about it, and even to my dad, though they were divorced. There was enough worry when I was growing up before university. I hoped instead that, whatever other feelings they had, they would feel proud of me for going home. I thought especially of my dad, whose birthplace was a mere 12 kilometers from where this airplane would land. 12. Welcome to Al-Quds. Ben-Gurion Airport is located near the suburb of Lud, Israel, once known as Lida, Palestine. This is the village of my father's and grandfather's family, who were expelled that summer of 1948. My father has never been able to return. Lida was the last town to fall during the Nakba. Perhaps not surprisingly, among all the Welcome to Israel signs in the airport, there is nothing to indicate that 700,000 Palestinians were driven away and that death, displacement, or refugee status has followed them ever since their eviction from an ancestral home. I could still remember how sick I'd felt arriving in Toronto as an Albertan Arab hick. It was the first time I had taken a long flight on my own away from Edmonton. Here, at the Israeli-managed customs control, I was nervous in a different way. It was as if I had "Up with Palestine" stamped across my chest. Standing in line, I noticed that some people moved quickly through customs. Jews were asked a few questions and left to proceed. Everything was calm, efficient, and dignified. An African-American and I were not so lucky. We were both interrogated by security agents as if they were being paid by the question. Where are you going? What is the purpose of your visit? Where does your family live? Where does your family come from? The minutes dragged on. The officer continued to ask probing questions, and I kept telling her that I was going to be studying at the Islamic University of Gaza. Eventually, the ordeal stopped. As I gathered my belongings, I asked the security agent why she had questioned me so thoroughly. "You weren't special," she said, as if that explained everything. And, in a way, it did. In 1995, Fatah, a Palestinian political party that was aligned with Yasser Arafat's PLO, had supported the interim agreement on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, commonly known as Oslo II, which not only legitimized a Jewish state on the 78% of Palestinian land Israel had occupied since 1947, but had offered them an additional 12%, which left Palestinians with less than 10% of their original country. After the failure at Camp David, many Fatah factions had deserted the party and joined Hamas, which did not support the Oslo II Accord. In this destabilized environment between the Camp David summit and my arrival at Ben-Gurion Airport, one or more of these factions had launched attacks on Israel. The additional scrutiny was part of Israel's heightened vigilance in the wake of these attacks. I finally got through customs and took a shuttle bus to downtown Jerusalem. After the 13-hour flight, I needed a meal. "I want to go to Old Jerusalem," I said to the driver. "Yeah, yeah, yeah," he said over the cranked-up klezmer tunes. He insisted on $15 for the ride when I had been told it should be only 10. I was not willing to pay the extra fee, so I turned away. One man on the bus said, "You know what you should have done to him? Punch him." All I could do was force a smile and wave my hand dismissively, as though it wasn't worth my time. I got on another bus and asked the driver if it was going to Jerusalem Square. I remembered those questions at the airport. "Why are you visiting? Why are you here? Where will you be staying?" I hadn't planned the specific details in advance. I had only decided to go a week before I booked my trip, so I was lucky to have come this far after the security grilling. I knew only that I wanted to go straight to the old city. When I got off the bus, I found a hostel close to the city gates, checked in, and went out to find some food. My hostel was located almost in the shadow of the Haram es-Sharif, right by the Masjid al-Aqsa. As I sat in a nearby cafe, a man came out of nowhere and began telling me story after story of people he had helped. My eyes were glazed with jet lag. I was not taking in much of what he was saying, but it did not take him long to discover that I came from Canada. That was when he began asking things like, "Can you help me go to Canada? How can I do it?" "I can't get you there," I said, "but take this." I gave him the contact information for the Canadian Arab Friendship Association and told him to talk to Yazan Haimour, I figured Uncle Yazan would know what to do. Despite the masjid being just steps away, I missed the prayers at Masjid al-Aqsa on the first day of my time in Palestine. So I went to find some breakfast and figure out my next steps. I ordered coffee and stared at the shops and restaurants around me, the colors and motion blurring together. As I sat drinking my coffee, I heard two guys chatting away about Palestine in a mix of English and in Arabic. They saw me staring at them and smiled. "Won't you join us?" I spent the rest of the day chatting and arguing with Wal and his friend Michael, a Palestinian Christian lawyer who had been educated in the United States. When Michael left, Wal and I carried on talking. As I got up to leave to return to my hostel, I told Wal that he had convinced me to register at Al-Quds University as soon as possible to study Arabic and religion. "No," Wal replied, "you will stay at my place and I'll help you to register." Wal shared an apartment with a friend in Abu Dis, a suburb of Jerusalem. I began to refuse, saying it was too much trouble, but my resistance was half-hearted. I had heard about Abu Dis because it had been suggested as a potential location for the Palestinian capital. Wal was persistent, and it did not take long for me to agree to stay at his place for the night. I retrieved my suitcase from the hostel while he found a servise, a minibus taxi, to take us to Abu Dis. Fear came creeping back. He seemed like a good guy, but I began praying to myself, thinking of my mother and father. Would they be bringing my body back home, if I could even be identified, or if there was even a body to find? Would I end up one of those people who mysteriously disappears when far from home? The ride to Abu Dis was a dark one, with the lights of Jerusalem fading away as we entered the Israeli-controlled Palestinian suburb. By the time the servise finally stopped at a four-story apartment building, my mind was whirling and my palms were slippery with sweat. Wal insisted on paying for the servise. Wal and his roommate, Muhammad, showed me to my room. The barking and howling of wild dogs outside did nothing to settle my mind. I was exhausted but restless, thinking about how Israel had renegotiated a new deadline with the PLO, how the Palestinians were to be given their freedom by this day, 13th September 2000. What would the morning and the days ahead bring? I got up and prayed and asked God to take care of me. I also thought about how great it would be to be able to send home news about Palestinian freedom to my father. He, and others like Uncle Faisal, said they hoped things would improve here as they said goodbye to me in Edmonton. The next morning, Wal suggested I move in with them. I thanked him for his kind offer, but told him I wanted to stay in the old city for a while so I could be close to the masjid and get to know the place before making final decisions about where to live. According to Israeli myths, the country of Palestine was mostly an empty desert, inhabited by a few struggling Palestinian villages, until the Israelis came along and, with their agricultural methods, redeemed the arable land before it was too late. What they were doing, they said, was superior to what the native farmers like my grandfather had done. Even during the British mandate, Israel tried to convince the world that Palestine was an uninhabited desert, a land without people for a people without a land. This terra nullius concept has been used many times to defend colonization, including in Canada to justify the occupation of the prairies and their transformation into the Canadian breadbasket. As I discovered the many historical buildings and sites of Palestine, I kept confirming that this story was the real myth. Wal often came to spend time with me in the old city, and we became good friends. One day, Wal and I talked late into the evening once more. It would be a struggle for him to find transport back to his house at that time of night, so I suggested he stay at a hostel with me, so that we could continue our conversation. We found a hostel in the northern part of Jerusalem's old city and asked for rooms for the night. The manager looked at my Canadian passport and was happy to have me stay at the hostel, but he would not let Wall stay there. "No Arabs allowed," he kept saying. Muwaffa and Wall, both Palestinian names, belonging to people who both look Middle Eastern. It made no sense except in Al-Quds. Wall had grown up in Jenin, whereas I was from Canada. With a shrug, this manager told me to try other hostels. So we did. But it was the same. They would accept me, but not my friend, my fellow traveler, my brother. One meaning of the Arabic name Wal is seeking shelter, and yet that is the one thing that was eluding us. Eventually, we did find a hostel. It was run down and clearly needed the business. The person at reception reluctantly allowed both of us to stay for one night, but the reaction was still nasty. If this had happened in Canada, I would have given the person behind the counter a piece of my mind, but in Al-Quds, things were different, I'd realized. As I was getting into bed, I asked Wall, "How do you feel?" "Oppressed. Hurt." I could feel the pain in his gestures, his voice, and his eyes. He then turned over and we both went to sleep, or at least he did. I was fuming. I wanted to destroy my passport, that piece of paper that made me look as though I was better than my brother. I thought to myself, the worst thing he's probably done is drink alcohol, and only God knows the trouble and havoc I caused as a teenager growing up in Canada. I swear, Wall's little toe was worth four of me. I got quite worked up, thinking of him here, oppressed, while I lived a very different life in Canada, complete with freedoms and at least a superficial sense of happiness, despite the threats, stigma, and displacement that strained my family. Across from each other in the hostel bunk beds, I was a world away from this stranger who was treating me as a brother. That was when I decided to ask Wall if the offer to stay with them was still open. 13. The Children of Palestine. The unarmed Intifada produced poignant cultural artifacts, many of which are freely available on the Internet. As I browse the Internet, I can look at photographs of Palestinian children from the First Intifada. I see kids the same age as I was when I lived with my family in Amman, Jordan. Dressed in yellow shorts, t-shirt, and sandals, one youth is aiming a stone at a huge Israeli tank. If I had been a youth in Palestine at that time, I might have been one of the children following orders to roll tires onto roads, pour gasoline on them, and set them on fire. Even Ehud Barak, a former Israeli prime minister, once said, "If I were a Palestinian of the right age, I would join, at some point, one of the terrorist groups." The posters I think of most often as I reflect on my time in Palestine show kids with slingshots and burning tires, and a boy in profile holding up his hand against Israeli soldiers in a tank. "An unceasing intifada will defeat the occupation," says the writing underneath his picture. Another poster declares, "Palestinian children are stronger than the occupation, and I have no doubt that is true." Like most Palestinians, both in Palestine and in the diaspora, I do not wish for the conflict to continue endlessly, but I also know that the resistance to occupation must be sustained. I know in my heart that in every Palestinian generation, there will be a group of children, men, women, and organizations that will lead that resistance. While I was in Palestine during the days leading up to the Second Intifada and the days immediately following the protests that broke out shortly after my arrival, I met many Palestinian children who had grown up in an environment of permanent war and occupation, and even some who had been shot at by Israeli soldiers. Even as they lived in despair, or perhaps because they lived in despair, I was surprised by how they still managed to behave like children anywhere else in the world, getting into arguments with their siblings and their friends. Occasionally, I would try to talk with them and get them to make peace, But as I walked away, I would see them going at it again. The resilience these children show under these circumstances made me wonder who the intended audience was for some of the posters about kids being stronger than the occupation, the Israelis and the uncaring world at large, or those of us who doubt the resilience of children. Was it to reassure parents their kids would survive? Or was it to encourage children whose parents were missing, imprisoned, or murdered? I do not know the answers to these questions, but I do know this: those children will survive. I remember giving some kids on the streets money and being surprised when they threw it back at me. Once I paid a young vendor for a box of Kleenex, but conveniently forgot to take them when I left. He ran after me and shoved it in my hand. "I'm a businessman," he said. "I don't need handouts." I soon learned that handouts insulted their dignity and took away their pride. They would not take handouts, not from me, and not from the Israelis. These children will continue to fight until the last occupier leaves. While I lived with Wal in Abu Dis, I made an effort every day to take a service to the old city to attend prayers at the holiest of masjids. Going to Al-Aqsa usually cleared my mind, at least for a while. On my second morning with my new friends, I woke up not knowing where I was. I had dreamt of meeting Tuma, my grandfather. The dream was still with me as I turned on the tap full blast to wash my face. I wished he and all his loved ones could drink it, splash in it, make tea with it, and take a hot shower to wash all the dust and fatigue away. My father and Uncle Faisal told me there had been times when there was too much water, when water dripped, even poured through the leaky roof of the refugee camp tent. Sometimes people would catch some in containers. Being forced to move again, though, meant they were often thirsty. At the most desperate times, like when they were on the death march leaving Lida, they had to drink urine. Sometimes they would find a well and suck the water off the clothes of the kid who had been lowered down to get the first scoop. I dried my face and then set out for the masjid. After morning prayers, I walked through the old city. Walking along Jaffa Street, I was surrounded by Western-type venues that were clearly geared to tourists. It struck me that I was one of those tourists, and I vowed I would get to experience the Palestine that lay beyond the tourist sites. It was still early, but it was already scorching, hotter than Edmonton in summer. Alberta had the prairies, but this place had the desert. I felt parched and dehydrated. I walked into a pub and asked for a glass of water. The occupation has affected Palestinian access to water significantly. My grandfather had been a farmer, living free, and in later life, a gardener. He always had access to water. Now, Israeli settlers get their water from more than 40 deep holes, plenty for gardens, swimming pools, and miles of crops and greenhouses. If Tuma were alive today, he would not be able to access this life source. The Israeli military routinely destroys Palestinian water tanks as part of their rules of occupation. Palestinians have to get permits to dig wells, and the red tape involved in getting such a permit makes it almost impossible. I was thirsty every day. Back home, clean water just comes gushing out of the taps. If the water supply is cut off for a day or so, we can rely on the state to help us get water back into our bodies to keep going. For occupied peoples in Palestine, a water shortage might be the beginning of the end. Many conflicts in Palestine result in severe water shortages and sewage overflows because of damage to the water and sanitation infrastructure. Palestinians have been waiting for decades for Israel to deliver on its promises to restore access to clean water in their homeland, but little happens. Besides thirsting for water merely to survive and risking being attacked for trying to obtain water, Palestinians also endure occasional Israeli Defense Forces visits. I remember staying at a friend's place one night on the outskirts of Tul Karem when I woke to the sound of the Israeli Defense Forces talking over CB radio outside our house. There is a constant awareness among Palestinians that the Israeli military is checking up on them, looking into their lives, and intimidating people with their presence. My efforts to attend daily prayer seemed to inspire my other roommate, Muhammad, who decided to join me at the masjid to pray and to talk to some of the elders. We prayed in the Masjid al-Aqsa, which had opened recently after reconstruction, and also at the Masjid al-Marwani, another place of worship built on Haram es-Sharif. Muhammad said he had not prayed for years, which shocked me. I was from the West and had come to Jerusalem, the city of peace, to seek out religion. I was moved when he joined me in prayer. One day outside the Masjid, I heard a tour guide telling a group of Western tourists about the impact the occupation had had on the lives of Palestinians. He spoke with authority and obvious knowledge, and I could not stop myself from following him around so I could hear more. At the end of the tour, I introduced myself to the guide, a man by the name of Ali Jeddah. During the tour, he had spoken openly about his involvement in the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and acknowledged that he had spent 17 years in prison for bombing Israeli targets in 1968. I was struck by his continued dedication to the cause despite the many hardships he'd suffered. When we parted, Ali gave me his business card. I kept his card close to me at all times while I was in Jerusalem. Maybe it was naive of me, but I thought that it might offer me some protection if I were stopped on the streets. If people saw I knew Ali Jeddah and was willing to call him to vouch for me, they might think twice about arresting me or prevent them from thinking I was a spy. I considered his card an informal passport into this locked-down city of Jerusalem. On my way home, I retraced parts of the route Ali Jeddah had taken during his tour. This time I looked at things differently. I noticed the stark contrast between the spacious homes in the Jewish quarter of West Jerusalem and the cramped living spaces in the Muslim and Christian parts of the city. When I stopped to buy something to eat, I asked the shopkeeper how he felt about the Jewish homes in the Muslim quarter that openly displayed the Israeli flag. "It is illegal to put even a picture of Arafat in front of our homes," the shopkeeper replied. "In Jerusalem, there are also cameras everywhere, and every move you make can be recorded." I told him that kind of thing was an issue in the West because of human rights. He just looked at me and replied, "I see you are from a very different place." In the street, I could see some kids playing in the street. "Will they grow up to struggle like Ali?" I wondered. One young boy looked exactly like my brother Omar. I finished my food and went over to the boy. I asked him what his name was. "Adnan," he said. He kept asking me questions. "Who was I? Where was I from? Was I a spy?" He tugged at my heart, for he was just as curious as Omar had been as a young boy. Sadly, Omar had got caught up at Edmonton's gang life and was struggling. I felt homesick. I could not help Omar get his life back on track, but I could give Adnan something to engage his mind. When I left, I gave Adnan some money, which he took. I saw Adnan often after that, and each time we chatted. He took an interest in my camera and wanted to know how it worked, so I showed him and let him carry it around for me as I made my way through the city. That way, he could earn the money I gave him. There were posters on the walls of a masjid that had been shut down by the Israelis. "Up with the Intifada," the writing on one of the posters screamed. It showed a boy whose hand could barely hold the rock he is about to throw, and I thought of Ali Jeddah's children, the ones who loved to draw but drew only what they saw in the streets of the old city. Ali had told us about the clashes between the police and Muslims who wanted to pray at a local masjid. At home in Canada, we had our troubles, but no one had ever shut down our mosque. The shopkeeper was right. I was now in a different place. 14. Chaos at Masjid al-Aqsa. Bearing witness to history can be dangerous and terrifying. It was Thursday, the 28th of September 2000, the day the hardline Zionist candidate Ariel Sharon was coming to visit the Masjid al-Aqsa. This part of the old city is filled with ancient stone walls, narrow alleyways, and arches. Over the past few weeks, I had been taking photos, and here I took a few more. When I developed the pictures and reviewed some of them, I could see and feel the tension and the power dynamics between the Israelis and Palestinians. In one picture, Israeli horses and police officers with tinted one-way sunglasses overpower Palestinian protesters. The power dynamics between victim and aggressor is clearly illustrated. It seemed that the troops had multiplied in preparation for Sharon's visit. There were hundreds of them standing on top of crumbling buildings and filling the streets. More than anything else, their presence indicated that Ariel Sharon, a former Israeli defense minister who had overseen the massacre of thousands of Palestinians, knew exactly what symbolic power was attached to the timing of his visit, and that he understood well how he stood to gain politically from provoking the Palestinians. The following day, 29th September, would mark Rosh Hashanah, the start of the Jewish New Year, which was a significant event for Orthodox Jews. The Likud party that he had founded with another former Prime Minister and Minister of Defense, Menachem Begin, relied on the support of these hardline conservative voters, and he knew that visiting the Masjid al-Aqsa would be a show of force that would solidify their support for his party. He undoubtedly also knew that 2nd of October marked the start of Rajab, one of the four sacred months in Islam, during which battles are prohibited, except in self-defense. The name of the month means respect, but it can also signal veneration or fear and awe of God. Ariel Sharon wanted to make Palestinians fear and respect him, as if he were a god. The presence of heavily armed soldiers and police just before a month in which Muslims are to live peacefully was a deliberate provocation that emphasized fear and awe and contradicted his stated mission of peace. I met Adnan outside the gates of the old city. From there, we walked toward the Lion's Gate, one of the main gates of Jerusalem, together. As we approached the gate, I saw several journalists, one from Reuters News Service, two Arabs, an Israeli, and one freelancer. They were all denied entry, even the Israeli. Having seen what was happening to the other journalists who had cameras with them, I was certain I would be denied entry as well. Fortunately, Adnan was quick and sharp and assessed the situation in an instant. He rushed up to me and took the camera. He quickly shot some photos of the action and even managed to get me in some of the shots. I was glad that he had taken the initiative. Even if I couldn't get further than this, I now had evidence to show my father, Uncle Yazan, Uncle Faisal, and others back home that I had been there and wasn't just showing them pictures that any tourist might have taken. Some soldiers in a big blue van called Adnan and me over and frisked us. I was carrying my school bag. As one of the soldiers took it, he asked me, "What are you doing here? Why are you here?" In that moment, I was terrified. There was too much happening, and I could not process it all. I wondered whether I, too, would be turned away like the Palestinians, or whether they would let me go. As scared as I was, I also did not want to sell out my people. I thought about how I had done that when I told people my name was Mo, because I was embarrassed by my Arabic heritage. This time I wanted to acknowledge my heritage. If anyone had a right to be afraid in this situation, it was Adnan and the other Palestinian youth. They knew these soldiers, and they knew what they could and could not do, yet there Adnan was beside me, defiant as ever. "I am a Canadian visiting Palestine, learning about my Palestinian heritage, and teaching English at Al-Quds University, I said when the soldiers asked me what I was doing there. The Israeli soldier tried to speak to me in very broken Arabic, but I could not understand him, so I asked, "Can you speak English to me?" Another soldier came up and stared at me. "Have you ever been to prison?" I laughed and pointed to the passport his partner was holding. "You've got my passport. You can see I am Canadian. If I had been in prison, I probably wouldn't be here now. Why do you ask?" The soldier stared at me in silence for a while before waving me and Adnan through. They let me go. Lucky, unlucky, lucky. It was a game of chance. I must be many times blessed. Slowly we made our way towards the masjid with the crowd. As we approached Al-Aqsa, I could see Ali Jeddah. He couldn't stop himself from being where the action was. All around me, the noise of conversation in Hebrew, Arabic, English was getting louder and more agitated. Even if I wanted to enter the masjid, there was no chance of that happening. Right in front of me stood the biggest man I'd ever seen in my life, an Israeli soldier all dressed in black. I'm 6'2", but he was about 5 inches taller and around 350 pounds, solidly built and holding an assault rifle. As I moved away, the tension around me unraveled into chaos. As Sharon arrived at the Masjid Al-Aqsa, some people rushed up to the security line and started to throw stones, but the Israeli soldiers and bodyguards held tight. The crowd yelled at Sharon, shouting for him to stop the instigating and get out of the sacred Masjid Al-Aqsa. Soldiers were shooting rubber bullets at the demonstrators. They were supposedly non-lethal bullets, but I knew enough to know that these kinetic impact munitions can cause bone fractures, internal organ injury, permanent disability, and even death. I saw two men being quickly bandaged up, the heavy gauze hanging limp in the air before it was wrapped tightly around their wounds, and then returning to the line. I saw an old man being clubbed on the head by a soldier. I could hear it crack on the man's skull, it was so close. Amid the swinging clubs, the blood, the falling, people began to shout, "Allahu Akbar!" Even in this wild scene, they were not yelling things like, "Death to Israelis," or "Die, stupid enemy." They just confirmed their allegiance to God. The phrase literally means, "God is great," and is used as a shocked expression or invocation, like saying, "Oh my God." The expression is also used to symbolize the fact that even though Palestinians are weaker now, we have God on our side. If we are overpowered by Israeli weapon power, we will invoke the greatness of God, who is bigger and larger than anyone, to take back our rights. But here, in the midst of the protest, it sounded like a battle cry, and I knew how it would be misinterpreted on television. Somewhere in the crowd, I could hear Ali Jeddah joining in with his strong voice, keeping others going when they were short of breath. I found myself saying, "Allahu Akbar," too, for only God could intervene in this chaos. Men and youths with rocks, chairs, and garbage cans, even school kids with backpacks and bags stuffed with books, were scrambling to find stones to throw. And around us, the Israeli police were letting loose with rubber bullets and tear gas. The screaming was getting more personal. "Murderer! Murderer!" the Palestinians shouted and chanted, some of them pursuing Sharon down the Haram es-Sharif. "We will redeem the Haram with blood and fire. Take that, for Sabra and Shatila." On the other side, some Orthodox Jews were screaming, "Go back to Mecca." I could feel my asthma kicking in, so I pulled back. I covered my nose and mouth, but even so, I felt the asthma getting worse. I reached into my bag and pulled out my inhaler. I watched the events unfold from a distance while I waited for the medication to kick in. I could see two Israeli policemen being rushed away on stretchers. Nearby, Palestinian officials were protesting loudly about how they had been beaten on the head by police officers. Abdul Malik Dahamshe, an Israel Arab MP, joined the chanting crowd. "All the time Sharon wants to see more blood, more killing," Dahamshe shouted. My asthma felt more under control, so I rejoined the crowd. As we moved away from the masjid, my heart was pounding. More scuffles broke out between Jews and Arabs, and more soldiers were arriving to break up the fighting. People seemed to know they could not keep it up, not here, not today. The demonstration fizzled out. Things died down. I found Adnan and got my camera back. We made our way to the city gates and left the old city smoldering with tires and emotion behind. When I left Edmonton, feeling the strong hugs of my family, I hadn't expected to find myself in what would be called the worst violence here for several years on the news. Was it just a day of commotion with some awful injuries, my asthma going overtime, and then everyone going back to their places? I walked around outside the old city looking for an internet cafe where I could sit down and let the adrenaline work its way out of my body as I wrote down my thoughts. 15. Violence in the streets. It was Friday, a day of prayer, the day after Sharon's appearance at Masjid al-Aqsa. Almost 20,000 Muslims had gathered at the Masjid for dawn prayers, and with them came the rows of police officers. They were clearly there to intimidate the faithful after the events of the previous day. I was still on the bus to Jerusalem, hoping to be at the Masjid for Dhuhr prayer time at noon, when news began to filter through to us over the radio. As people hopped onto the microbus, they relayed what they had heard. The demonstrations began right after prayers. Youth were throwing rocks as if their lives depended on it, because their lives do depend on this struggle. When the police could no longer handle the barrage of angry youth, the soldiers in full riot gear came in and started shooting at people, live ammunition as well as rubber bullets. The Palestinian Authority had spoken up. On its official radio station, the Voice of Palestine, it had called on all Palestinians to come and defend Al-Aqsa. Even though Palestinians often sneered at the PA because they felt the organization was only serving its own interests and working with Israel to undermine Palestinian interests, people listened. Schools were closed and students arrived at the Haram es-Sharif in buses. Speakers were blasting Arabic beats, almost always including Ahmad Kabur's greatest hit, Una Dikam, which had recently been re-released. When I had stood outside Edmonton's Al-Rashid Mosque with my pellet gun as a 13-year-old almost exactly a decade before, I had thought that I might die and had wondered why a mere child should be made to carry a weapon. Now I was on a bus headed into a battlefield armed only with my curiosity. But I was beginning to understand the questions a naive young boy in Edmonton could not answer. Wall, Muhammad, and Ali had warned me not to go into the city for prayers, but rather to go to a local masjid in Abu Dis, but I imagined I could use my Canadian passport to get me through blockades and out of trouble if necessary. The bus driver dropped us off as close to the old city as he could get, and I walked the rest of the way. I was in the thick of things now, surrounded by real heroes, people who faced real bullets. This time I was not a child standing outside the mosque with a pellet gun mired in self-pity. I could smell the fear, feel it, hear it. I could sense the tension, the courage, and the hesitation. I was tense, scared, and excited. I was finally living the stories I had only heard from others or had read about. A bullet pinged by my leg. It frightened me, and I felt a nauseating rush in my body. This was really happening. Then the action fell into sequence. I could feel my body dissociating from the events, and it felt as though I was watching the day unfold in a movie. Detaching myself from the here and now was the only way I could cope with the trauma I was experiencing. I wondered whether I would die a martyr, or whether I would be a spectator only. I was confused, worried, excited, scared. Amid the chaos that was unfolding round me at Al-Aqsa, as I was gasping for breath, I thought, "Dad, I love you. I love you, and I don't know how you made it." I never knew what it was like for you and the others. If I die, Dad, Mom, will you be happy I am a martyr? Two more bullets flew by near my head. I shook myself. I didn't have to die now. I should be as smart as those kids hiding behind the trees. I could see things slamming against the trunks. There were sounds, crackling, spattering, whining, and popping. Not rocks. I was only 100 meters away from the soldiers, and I could see plainly that they were firing at people indiscriminately, men, women, children. It did not matter to them. And even as the bullets headed one way, rocks were going the opposite direction. It was raining rocks, hundreds of them, big and small, flying with speed and force that didn't seem possible. They were hitting the riot police shields, drumming into them and bouncing off like hail. Bullets continued to whiz by in response. When I had caused trouble in Edmonton, I could predict possible outcomes and could assess the risks. But here it was different. I had arrived in the old city wanting to be part of the action, but I quickly realized I was out of my depth. Instead of joining the protesters, I stood on the sidelines and turned to doing what I knew, which was taking videos. As much as I would have loved to be part of the action, I knew that what I could contribute was to create a video record. In the frenzy of the moment, I tried to get my video camera to work so that I could film what I was seeing. It did not help that I could see the Mustarabin, the Israeli soldiers that look Arabic and speak Arabic, joining the protesters and egging them on. Then, in a split second, they would pull black masks over their heads and start arresting protesters. The crowd kept pushing towards Kubbat al-Sakra, the Dome of the Rock, cornering the blue-uniformed riot police who were stationed at the gates. They started firing rubber bullets at the crowd as they retreated. As they retreated, the green uniforms of the Israeli Defense Forces started to join them, running from the gate closest to Kubbat al-Sakra. Their weapons weighed heavily on their bodies. I could hear the sound of the gunfire change with their arrival. They were shooting live rounds. Unlike the riot police who fired shots into the ground, the IDF soldiers were aiming directly at the crowd. They were aiming to kill. The riot police, emboldened by the presence of the IDF, began to push forward again. Now their fire became more focused, deliberate. This time there was live ammunition as well as rubber bullets. I knew they were live bullets because people stopped throwing stones and turned to run away when the soldiers dressed in green started to shoot indiscriminately into the crowd. People fell and some did not get back up. With rubber bullets, people got back up and pushed closer. They were not doing that now. Also, there was more blood as the live bullets struck people and exploded. As I ran for cover under fire of the bullets, I saw people being hit in the legs and in the head. One youth was struck in the forehead. He died instantly. Blood spouted from his head as demonstrators fled. Those who couldn't get out of the Kubbat al-Sakra complex clung to the shadow and sanctuary of the masjid, but they couldn't escape the bullets. I saw blood everywhere. Another bullet flew past. A man died in front of me, 3 meters away. I moved along with the crowd. Just outside the masjid, I heard someone yell, "Hey, you!" I jumped. It was an Arab youth, one of a group who had positioned themselves at the entrance to the masjid to check that no Mustarabin were trying to enter. I could see from their faces that they were prepared to hurt anyone who tried to stop the rioters or the people throwing stones from the rooftops. He continued to shout at me in Arabic, fear and anger twisting his face into a grin. "Where are you from? What are you?" I began answering him, talking very fast. "You're Arabic," he said. "It sounds foreign." I couldn't believe it. In this hell, he was criticizing the way I spoke. He had others with him. I thought they were going to kill me. I found myself scrambling in my pocket and bag. "Here, man, look at my Canadian passport. I'm not Israeli. I have an Arab name." While the youth was interrogating me, I caught sight of Adnan among the crowd outside the premises. I shoved the camera into his hands and told him to shoot videos of me, just like he had the day before. "It's okay," said the youth at the checkpoint. "If you don't have weapons, go and find cover, and don't be some idiot from Canada." I wanted to find shelter more than anything else at that moment, but I was fighting my way through a cloud of tear gas and unable to get out. The allegedly non-lethal gas ripped into my nose and eyes and tore through my mouth and lungs as I struggled to breathe. I felt an asthma attack closing in on me again, just like the day before. I needed to close my stinging eyes. I was blinded. I managed to crouch behind a wall. In the chaos, I'd lost sight of Adnan. I gulped and wheezed, fighting the tear gas. I remembered how, as students, we joked about the information that was printed by the university to manage risk from usually peaceful rallies on campus. If you are in a crowd that is being dispersed involuntarily by the police, it is important to leave in larger groups so that you will have witnesses and support. Some tactics used by police are pepper spray, tear gas, etc. Right now, I thought, I could use a support group to get me out of here. What I knew about tear gas came from student information sessions and pamphlets. Its effects wear off quickly, the pamphlets said. It wasn't just babies and old people who could suffer more permanent damage. What they didn't tell you, or what I couldn't remember, was how to stop the searing pain. I don't know where it came from, but all of a sudden, like a blessing, there it was, a long piece of cloth stuffed into my hand. I was still trying to be an international observer, looking out from my refuge with tear-streaked eyes as I wheezed and choked, and this scarf came to my rescue out of nowhere. I slapped it against my face and tied it behind my head. This was not Dickensfield High in Edmonton, where I had put on a show with a misunderstood scarf. This keffiyeh was a lifeline. In 1987, during the First Intifada, I was just beginning to understand what being Palestinian meant. I was only 10 years old and in Canada when the Palestinian uprising erupted in the Israeli-occupied territories. It began with violence and fighting as intense as in 1948 and 1967. Whenever I heard about it in bits and pieces, it was from my family or other adults. They had come to Canada for a better, safer future. By 1993, the sixth year of the First Intifada, it seemed the Palestinians had at last received some recognition and respect from the Western world, but there was little from Israel and no commitments for change. Now, in this moment, as I crouched behind a wall in Old Jerusalem, I did not think of myself as Canadian. Yes, I had grown up and had lived there most of my life, but right then I felt as if Palestine had been my lifelong home. I felt the loss of loved ones more closely than ever before and could imagine having had my home bulldozed. I felt that I personally had been suspected, arrested, and tortured, and was always watched, taunted, and targeted. In that moment, it was as though I had lived for years under Israeli occupation, trying to keep the family together, seeing violence many days in the year, hearing about wars and demonstrations. A citizen of nowhere, someone who knew only occupation. When people experience the barrage of injustices as Palestinians have endured for generations, they will double their efforts to achieve justice for themselves and their children. Being victimized generation after generation was not making Palestinians cower. On the contrary, that was what made my people a threat to Israel. In this moment, I realized I was witness to the crimes committed against us, and as my breathing eased under the keffiyeh, I thought how our survival incriminated our oppressors. I'd first seen the Palestinian flag, red, green, black, and white, at home in Canada in a parade. There it was simply a flag, a symbol of identity among many others. Here, every time the Palestinian flag was raised, bullets were fired. At one point, I could hear a man shouting over the loudspeakers about a massacre, calling for ambulances. Back home, I had heard about massacres in Palestine. Now I was in the middle of one. How quickly would the ambulances get here? How efficient would things be? I thought of my eye injury as a child and being rushed to hospital by my father, driving like a madman, the police helping us get there even faster. That was not going to happen. Not here. Not today. Children were running behind cars, their feet pounding, raising clouds of dust, some trying to use slingshots, their hands frantic and angry. They were like any guerrilla army, working with the little they had. I saw makeshift weapons thrown at their targets, bottles smashing, gas igniting into a blossom of fire. I couldn't believe these children, how brave and brazen they were. One of them, about 13 years old, was being beaten by grown men. Not far from that horror, I came across a woman in her 60s wearing her traditional embroidered Palestinian abaya and a white hijab. She had a wound on her leg but was still cursing the soldiers as she threw the stones that other women were collecting for her. I don't know which was more terrible, the look on her face or the wound in her leg. Seeing her power reminded me of the strength of Palestinian Muslim women, the strength of my mother, who walked through dark city streets putting up her Herbalife posters to generate income as a single mother of five children. In her own way, my mother was fighting to preserve her culture and religion in Canada, and I knew she would have been formidable here in Palestine. Many of the Israeli soldiers on that terrifying day in September 2000 looked younger than me, perhaps 18 or 19. They did not look like a formidable Israeli force. Surrounded by an angry mob throwing rocks at them, they simply looked frightened. I struggled to understand why they were so frightened, fighting civilians who were mostly throwing rocks at live machine gun fire. The live ammunition kept coming, and people kept running and crawling through the gates. As we ran outside the gates, I heard the thud of Israeli clubs falling on the heads and backs of people behind me. Most of the people at the back of the crowd were women, both young and old. A woman fell down in front of me, but no one could get to her. There was too much chaos. As I saw her disappear under the feet of a fleeing crowd, I felt the oppression and the pain my parents carried. The loudspeaker put out a call that hospitals were looking for blood donors to help treat the wounded. Muhammad and I decided to find a service that could take us to the Makassed Hospital, which was the closest and easiest to get to from the Kubat al-Sakra. It was the one concrete thing I felt I could do to help. Every step Muhammad and I took away from the Al-Aqsa seemed to lead us into further protests. Both Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat were fools if they thought they could stop things now. It was madness. In some places, it was action that didn't end. How quickly the children I'd seen on the streets in the days before had become warriors. Children, just the age I'd been while trying to discover where I belonged in Edmonton. They had set up checkpoints at the periphery of the old city and looked more like adults than I had when I had defended Al-Rashid Mosque against vandals and violence. If I couldn't stand up outside a mosque for more than one night, what would I have been like at a checkpoint? As we arrived at the hospital, we saw soldiers on top of the hill and demonstrators at the bottom. Some of the protesters had the keffiyeh wrapped around their face and neck to prevent having themselves and their families recognized and targeted by Israeli forces. I had pulled mine off my face and used it to wipe off the sweat and dust. If my asthma got worse, I could surely get help at the hospital. Muhammad and I laughed nervously about that. The emergency rooms were filling up with the crushed and bloody humans being carried and pulled through the crowd, rushing to be treated at a backlogged, undersupplied hospital, or to be wrapped in an outlawed flag as a funeral shroud. We doubted that an asthma attack would be considered an emergency. As a Muslim and Arab in the West, I've had my own kind of suffering, and no doubt others who have immigrated to North America or who were born there will understand. Those who had always been here in the Middle East might have doubted me if I had told them that Canadian officers, such as members of the settler-serving RCMP or Constable Case Modell from the Edmonton Police Service, had some things in common with the Israeli forces. In the end, my efforts to get to one of the hospitals came to nothing. Even though I had donated blood in Canada, they would not accept my blood in Jerusalem, not even on a day when the Palestinian blood that flowed in my veins was being spilled not far from me. They said it was because I had asthma, but I found that hard to believe, as it had not prevented me from donating blood in Canada. There was no direct transport back to Abu Dis, which meant that we first had to go back to the old city to get a ride home. On the way back from the hospital, I again saw the elderly woman who had been throwing stones during the protests. She was still wearing her traditional embroidered abaya and was walking along, despite her wound. The man driving our vehicle was not slowing down, but I told him, "No, stop, pick her up. She is an old woman and deserves respect." To me, this woman was a revolutionary. She brought tears to my eyes. The driver stopped. When we arrived at a checkpoint, the driver was tense because he thought the kids there might begin throwing rocks at his bus. It certainly looked as though they might. The woman opened her window and yelled at them. It was like their mother or grandmother screaming at them. Embarrassed, they stopped what they were doing and let our bus pass undisturbed. It was almost humorous. The service driver stopped a little way from the gates, and the old woman and I walked the rest of the way to the old city. "I have been shot twice," she said as we went through the gate, "but every time they hit me, I come back stronger." 16. Family Ties. The old woman and I parted company just beyond the gates. She went home, and I caught a service back to Abu Dis. Safely back home after a full day at Al-Aqsa and then the hospital, Muhammad and I turned the dial on the radio until we found the Voice of Palestine radio station. I felt a strange sense of relief coming off the adrenaline. My eyes were no longer weeping uncontrollably, but they did feel scratchy from the chemicals. It would take a few days for my throat and lungs to stop burning. The announcer was calling events of the day the Battle of Jerusalem. The battle had followed the riots of Thursday, 28 September, when the tension that had built up around the circumstances of occupation was stoked and channeled by Ariel Sharon, his colleagues, and the armed Israeli officers. Hanan Ashrawi, a Palestinian legislator, scholar, and human rights activist, blamed the Israelis for a massacre against the Palestinians, describing their actions as deliberately targeting peaceful worshippers rather than perpetuating random violence. I thought of how Palestinians were portrayed in the news in North America. So often we were represented simply as Arab troublemakers. During my conversations with people I met and from reading the papers and listening to the news, I learned that 100,000 people had showed up in solidarity at a rally in Washington to protest Israeli occupation, oppression, and the destruction of Palestine. I wondered what the Canadian newspapers were saying, as I had not seen any mention of Canada's response to the crisis. When I heard Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak on the radio saying he hoped these incidents wouldn't affect the peace process and that parties seeking peace should stop fighting now, I felt a desire to talk to someone like Uncle Yazan back home, someone who could help me understand all the thoughts and feelings that flew through my head like bullets. Perhaps between the two of us, we could figure out why Barak would say the things he was saying. He had, after all, approved Sharon's visit to Haram es-Sharif. And anyway, how could people stop fighting just like that? Pretending, hoping, that life would have returned to normal, I went to Al-Quds first thing on Saturday morning. Mohammed came with me. I picked up a newspaper on my way to the bus stop. No city buses were entering Abu Dis, so I had to use a service. On the way into the city, the driver stopped to pick up a man. "What's the situation like in Jerusalem?" he asked as we boarded the bus. "Bullets flying, people dying," was the driver's response. A youth seated in front of us turned around. "Normal," he said. To me, the man was describing a place of carnage. For the children who grew up here, it was the status quo. At Edmonton, someone getting on the bus might talk about the weather. Here, you asked about people's safety, hoping to find out how strict the Israelis were being as they forced their control over Palestinians. Muhammad and I read the paper and listened to the radio on the way in. Ramallah, Beit Alahem, Tulkarem, Gaza, Nablus, all were on fire. When we drove close to the police checkpoint just outside the old city, Muhammad asked the driver of the Servizes to stop. He did not want to face the Israeli officers. But I told him to keep driving. He stopped at the checkpoint. The officers checked our documentation, then let us pass. How different it felt from the previous day when children had set up and staffed the checkpoints going out of the old city. Al-Quds was ghost-like and littered with rubble from the previous day. There were Israeli soldiers everywhere. Burned-out tires lay smoldering in the streets. They had been rolled into the street as a way to block the soldiers' view when the police fired on protesters, a toxic but ingenious way for protesters to protect themselves. I was noticing everything, soaking it up, breathing it in. It stung. All the shops were closed, either in protest or as a sign of respect for those who had been killed in the conflict. To soothe the trauma of the day, we decided we needed some real Palestinian food. We found a man barbecuing some kebabs on the street. Muhammad and I stood amid the carnage, listening to the sizzle of the meat, watching the smoke from his grill rising into the air. We watched with admiration as he carefully turned the kebabs loaded with vegetables. As I took in the devastation and ate my kebab, the news about Ramallah gnawed at me. I had family there, and I wanted to see for myself what the situation was like for them, so Muhammad and I found a Servizes to take us there. Along the way, we passed through several Palestinian Authority checkpoints without incident, much to Muhammad's relief. We got to the outskirts of Ramallah around mid-morning and pulled up at another checkpoint. As we got off the bus while the authorities checked the vehicle, I made the mistake of pointing my camera at the ambulances and the PA officers. A PA soldier approached and asked what I was doing. "Just observing," I told him. "Are you a reporter?" he said. "Freelance." "Come and meet my superior." I think our driver must have known what was coming because he drove off as soon as the PA authorities started speaking to us. The officer asked for my passport. I gave it to him, and Muhammad also handed over his ID. I always felt a twinge of discomfort when I saw my passport leave my hands and end up in the hands of strangers who could do anything they wanted with it. In the superior's office, we were asked a few questions. Our bags were confiscated, and we were ordered to go and wait in the back of their jeep. After a while, I was told I could leave, but had to come back in the morning for questioning. Muhammad had to stay, they said. I refused to leave without my friend. "No, I will go for questioning now," I said. The officer shrugged. He didn't seem concerned either way. "The reason we are detaining you," he said as we walked back to the office, "is because the Israeli soldiers are using camcorders and filming people, so they are later investigated, and you have a camcorder." "You think I am Israeli?" The man shrugged. "Sometimes it is difficult to tell." I couldn't help but laugh wryly. I was learning that even here people saw me as different and had trouble accepting me for who I am. In Canada, white Canadians often asked me where I was from, as if saying I was from Edmonton was not enough. But it felt different somehow when a Palestinian doubted where I was from. In a reversal of my fortunes, Muhammad now was free to go, and I had to stay. I told him to leave, but he wouldn't. I threatened to make a big scene if he did not leave, but he stubbornly insisted that he would not abandon me. So they detained him as well. There we were, detained in one of the PA centers, confined by conflict and my desire to document this mayhem. As we walked in, the officers asked if we were hungry. We said yes, and they brought us a plateful of bamya with rice. As we ate, we sat and watched television reports of men and women being killed or finding their way to the hospital. The detention space was like a coffee shop, with no formalities. In fact, the whole thing seemed Hausa, confused and disorganized. we were asked questions in an intelligence agency building called a mukhabarat, which means intelligence. When we were done, we were told we were free to leave. As we walked through the front office, the officer there said, "Don't use your camcorder. The Palestinian authorities might imprison you for a month or so." We thanked him for the advice and left. As immersed as I was in the unfolding events, I realized, I remained a foreigner. They did not offer us a ride back downtown, so we found another service to take us into the city. We wanted to be there because we had seen on the television that there was open conflict on the edges of Ramallah, and we thought it might be safer downtown. As we drove into the city, we could see the Israeli soldiers firing at children who were throwing rocks. Beyond them, about 750 meters down the hill, I could see a hotel with some Israeli soldiers standing on the roof, shooting down at the protesters. I asked a nearby PA officer if I could use my camcorder. "Go ahead," he said, "but don't film people at close range and don't get too close to the hotel. Too many snipers." It was chaotic. People were throwing rocks at police and soldiers stationed on the ground. Tear gas smoke clung to the air and bullets were flying everywhere. Around me, the wounded fell to the ground. There they sat. Those who could took cover, holding onto their stomachs, legs, or arms, whatever part of their body was injured. Up against a wall, I heard bullets pinging close to my head, once, twice, three times. Fragments of cinder block flew into my face. I scrambled to the ground. A man nearby was shot in the leg. There was destruction everywhere. Tires on cars had been shot out. People were dying around me. A man in front of me was arguing with Israelis and getting beaten right in front of me. I thought of the man who had died in front of me in Al-Quds the day before. I had been standing right there with my camcorder. Even if I could have acted in time to film his death, I didn't know if it was better to record the action or to respect his moment of passing. I didn't know whether I could stomach a repeat of that experience less than 24 hours later. When the crossfire of bullets and stones settled down a bit, we left downtown Ramallah and headed back to Muhammad and Wall's place in Abu Dis. It was a mess everywhere as we drove home. My fingers were itching to take out my camcorder. The driver could tell what I was thinking. "No, don't do it. It's trouble." On the radio in the service, we heard that the man who had been shot in the head in Jerusalem was from Abu Dis. He was proclaimed a shahid, a witness, a martyr. In the past 2 days, I had seen the world as I knew it before shatter. As the news drifted over the airwaves, it dawned on me that I had witnessed the making of a martyr, a few feet to one side, and it could have been me. About a week after my trip to Ramallah, my cousin Reham and her husband Yusef invited me to visit for a couple of days. When my family lived in Jordan, Reham's family lived next door, and we visited all the time. In the middle of an exploding world, they invited me to come and visit. A normal invitation, as if nothing unusual was happening. "Hey, Mwafa, come and eat with us. Come and stay over. Your family." I longed for such a sense of normality. Reham and Yusef did not tell me about the constant IDF assaults where they lived, bullets, tanks, and gunfire during the night. The noise woke me up. Reham and Yusef were sound asleep. It was like just another night to them. Whenever I could, I used an online service to phone my dad. Witnessing death compelled me to reach out. But our conversations were difficult. Every time my father would say, "Come back here, come back. What are you doing there? Come back now." He always said the same thing, that it was dangerous in Palestine and that I'd be better off back in Canada with a steady job. I could not bring myself to tell him that several times I had nearly been killed or that there was little to draw me back to Edmonton. My father was in an unstable relationship. My mother and brothers were in Vancouver, and I often felt unwelcome in my own homeland. But I could tell him about Reham and Yusef and my visit to Hebron. I wanted to tell my family where I was and assure them that I was being hosted with care and hospitality in the Arab way. Reham and Yusuf let me use their phone. "I'm fine," I told my parents. "I am well fed and I have a good place to stay in Abu Dis, but last night was noisy." I couldn't bring myself to tell them the noise was from the fighting. My parents would have liked to be reunited with some of their family in Palestine. As it turned out, I was the missing link, the connector, and often in surprising ways. Sometimes, it seemed, God would guide me in the most unexpected ways. One morning in mid-October, I stopped a service to go to Bethlehem, but the driver said he was going to Ramallah. I was getting used to people asking me where I was from, so when the driver asked, I had an answer ready. "My family is from Lida," I told him. We were still talking about Lida and the fact that he was heading to Ramallah when the radio in the cab announced another funeral for a martyr, a member of the Al-Anati family. That was my mother's family. I wanted to pay my respects, so I dropped my plans of going to Bethlehem and instead asked the driver if he could take me to where the Azza funeral would be. He said he would. Maybe I shouldn't go, I thought, not knowing who this person was or what relation he had been to me. After all, the deceased was a distant relative connected to me through my great-grandmother's second marriage. Still, I wanted to go. In Ramallah, the cab driver asked around where the funeral was being held. Eventually, we found a child who said he knew where to go, but it turned out to be the wrong funeral. The whole city was grieving. Disoriented, I felt like an idiot, but the family was very friendly. They told me to walk 2 blocks to find the ceremony I was looking for. I knew everything would be okay. I walked into the place, a local youth club, and the first person I saw was Abu Khalid, my mother's uncle on her father's side. My mother's uncle. I knew his family from Jordan when we used to visit there. They were our neighbors. I was shocked at how close this martyr, the man being mourned, was to me. "I came all the way from Canada to pay my respects," I said to everyone. I was joking, but also serious. People were staring at me, nodding and smiling, whispering to each other. I offered my condolences to everyone, and some even remembered and recognized me. They seemed surprised, but happy to see me. I went along the row of people, shaking hands, and finally came to my mother's second uncle. We kissed and hugged, and he introduced me to the family, which was large. From Canada, Mwafa Hausa, son of Hanan Hanaim, and Saeed Hausa. It felt so good. I had not known I would find them when I went to the Middle East, though I had some vague idea of where they were. It was a funeral, yet the mood was not sad. People talked as they normally did, and they were smiling. In Islam, we are taught that martyrs are not dead. They are alive even though we are not with them. The idea is to rejoice because they are now with Allah, safe and at peace. While I was with my family in Ramallah to commemorate my mother's cousin's death, I went to pray in the nearby masjid. I will not forget that day. It was the 12th of October, and I recall having to clear debris off the floor before I could say my prayers because the Israeli soldiers had bombed the masjid. It was dark inside because the bombing had cut the electricity as well. That was also the day 2 Israeli undercover agents were lynched in Ramallah. At least I found some comfort in the knowledge that my mother's cousin, the late Imad Anati, who had been working with the Palestinian Authority, had died defending Ramallah and his family against the IDF, fighting against the oppressor for his homeland, family, and religion. I felt proud and began to understand what death is often like in the homeland. I began to compose a letter to my mother in my mind. "Dear Mother, I met many people, though some not directly. I have met your uncle, Abu Khalid, and I even met your cousin, Imad. He gave his life for Palestine." 17. Surrounded by family in the middle of a war. After I had offered my condolences to family in Ramallah and had prayed at the local masjid, I returned to Abu Dis. Wal and Muhammad had gone home to visit their families, so I was alone at home. In a way, I was glad to be alone because I needed the time alone to process recent events. When I got home, I discovered the power in our apartment had been turned off. To sit in the darkness with the power cut off, listening to the battery-powered radio, and learning about events that are occurring outside your doorstep is a surreal experience. There were no streetlights that could shine even a sliver of light into the apartment. I couldn't see my hand in front of my face until my eyes adjusted to the blackness. Whatever identity I had was stripped away, blacked out. Alone in the darkness, I replayed the memories of soldiers using rockets, tanks, machine guns, and bullets during protests. Now they were moving beyond the city centers, encroaching on the suburbs of Palestinian towns and refugee camps. The Israelis were shooting at houses, sparing no one. On the radio, a Palestinian from Ain al-Hilweh refugee camp in Lebanon had called in and was crying on the phone, saying, "I want to be with my Palestinian brothers and sisters to help them." Would the Israeli soldiers enter Abu Dis at night? The caller asked. Would they assault the town? Were we all suspect here? Is this why the power had been shut down? To offer them the cover of complete darkness? Under the agreement of the 1995 Oslo Accord, Abu Dis was under joint Israeli and Palestinian control. This meant that in most of the city, the Palestinian Authority took care of civilian matters, while Israel was in control of security. Clearly, electricity was considered a matter of security, for the Jerusalem Electricity Power Company provided electricity, and power cuts to our part of the city were not uncommon. Israeli needs came first. Abu Dis overlooked the Haram es-Sharif from near Jabal al-Zaytun, the Mount of Olives, so its proximity to Jerusalem made the city a contender for becoming the capital of a Palestinian state. Was it a target now? My mind whirled with questions in the darkness. With the IDF patrolling the streets and shooting indiscriminately, everyone was staying home to protect themselves. I hoped things would calm down and that the Israelis would get the message that Palestinians would continue to fight for our freedom until our death. The news reports were filled with accounts of conflicts between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians, and the Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, had asked the troops to withdraw, but people were still being killed and injured severely by his forces. Conflict was heating up, with the many Palestinians who lived inside Israel leading demonstrations against Israeli forces. During the Azza I had attended in Ramallah, I had met my family, one after another, all in mourning, yet defiant and proud that their family's blood had been spilled for the Palestinian struggle. One cousin had spent 10 years in prison. He was arrested when he was 16 for killing a collaborator and was sentenced to life imprisonment, but was released after a decade in prison and several appeals to his sentence. When I began meeting some of my own family and discovered that we had a martyr among us, the conflict had become personal, and I felt the effects of Israeli brutality even more. I realized that it could easily have been me who had died battling Israeli forces, defending Ramallah, and working with the Palestinian Authority. I went to bed in the dark with my head bursting with images and thoughts. I woke up in the middle of the night to the sound of gunfire. A truck with a blaring loudspeaker drove by our apartment. "O men of Abu Dis, come out and defend your town. The Israelis have invaded." I turned on my radio but couldn't find out anything to give me more information about what was happening outside. In this Israeli-controlled town, when Arab citizens were attacked by settlers, the Israeli state did not seem to consider this a matter of security and so did nothing. Citizens had to defend themselves. I could hear people coming out on the rooftops and opening their windows to see what was going on. The commotion went on for 3 hours after the announcement of an invasion. Then, in the early hours of the morning, a minor invasion of mosquitoes began. and I knew I wouldn't be going back to sleep. I felt attacked and itchy all over. I got dressed and sat waiting for the sun to rise over Al-Quds and bathe the Kubat as-Sakra in gold. Over the next few days, the violence continued in Jerusalem and Abu Dis, in Ramallah and Hebron, everywhere I'd been and where I had family. Through it all, the family connections grew stronger. I returned to my cousin Reham's house in Hebron, where I was wrapped in the warmth of traditional greetings and hospitality. Reham's husband, Yusef, was a dentist. He was an intelligent man who had lived for 19 years in the West, mostly in Romania. His father was the most welcoming and generous elder I met in Palestine. Every time I visited Reham and Yusef, the old man would take me to his tiny vineyard and give me fresh grapes off the vines. Many people found it hard to believe that I was here, that I had wanted to come and live among honorable people, but Yusef's father was not one of them. Every time we spoke, he encouraged me to stay in Palestine. I had an aunt who lived in Mukayam Balata, the refugee camp adjacent to Nablus in the northern West Bank. Aunt Huda was my mother's half-sister. She was very poor and had no relatives left in Palestine. Her children had left or were in prison. One of her children was killed by an Israeli soldier. As a result, Aunt Huda felt very isolated and lonely. She could not contain her excitement when I contacted her to ask if I could visit. I traveled alone to Nablus, stopping off again in Ramallah on the way there. It was chaos. Settlers were throwing rocks at Palestinian cars, and the streets were littered with rocks and glass. Nablus was closed off. To get there, I had to hitch a ride with the locals, who would speed through the mountains and villages, taking irregular routes. They knew every nook and cranny of this land. I had little choice but to trust them with my life and simply be a stunned passenger. In some ways, I had been the daring one back home in Edmonton, sticking my neck out, taking risks. But it was nothing like this. Back then, I sometimes thought I could feel my spirit dying. But here it might be my body departing along with it. I was not the only one trying to get into Nablus. Several of us crammed into an old Mercedes bus. The driver took us through mountain villages and back roads. My fellow passengers feared that settlers would act against us and that we might be killed by a soldier in one of the helicopters that circled above. As we crept through the empty streets of a village that was under a 24-hour curfew at the time, we were stopped by Israeli soldiers. They ordered us to get out of the car and demanded everyone's identification. "Where are you going?" they asked. One man, Muhammad, who was about 20, was asked whether he spoke Hebrew. "Ani lo meda ber ivrit." "No, I don't speak Hebrew," Muhammad replied, in Hebrew. The soldier looked at him for a moment, turned away, then suddenly spun back around and slapped him across the head. Muhammad staggered from the force of the blow. The rest of us stood frozen to the ground, stunned and unable to rush forward to defend one of our own. Muhammad's eyes looked shiny but stayed fixed on the soldier. A tear slowly formed in one eye and squeezed its way out. He fought back more tears and stood defiantly straight in the sun. The soldier stared back and we thought he was about to hit Muhammad again, when one of the other soldiers said to his colleague in Arabic, "Halas, enough." Then they let us go. We got back into the car and started off again. We were all silent, 100 unsaid things hanging over us. Finally, the old man next to me broke the silence. "Not to worry, son. All your mistakes will be forgiven to this day for that slap you received." All of us then consoled and congratulated him. Eventually, we got to Nablus. As soon as I sat down, my troubles left me, and I felt spoiled by the generosity my aunt extended to me. I did not want to sleep at her place because I knew that when Arabs have guests, they have to buy and purchase a lot of things, and I did not want to overburden Aunt Huda and her husband because they were poor. As the evening approached, I bid them farewell and found a hostel nearby where I could sleep the night. When I woke in the morning, my money was gone. Fortunately, the person was an honorable thief with enough compassion to leave me money to get back home to Abu Dis. I found a service that was headed back to Jerusalem and settled into my seat. When we arrived in Ramallah, there were more helicopters overhead. As I listened to the radio, I began to understand why we had encountered helicopters on the way to Nablus. It all had to do with the two Israeli soldiers who had been killed. Israel was exacting revenge. Ehud Barak's government claimed that the soldiers had taken a wrong turn when entering Ramallah and had not seen the Palestinian checkpoint flags. Usually, when Israeli soldiers were caught in Palestinian territories, they were returned. But this was during the height of the Intifada, and the soldiers were lynched, set on fire, and dragged around the streets of Ramallah. Their death reflected the tensions of the time. Above us, the Apache helicopters and airplanes continued to circle over Ramallah, dropping bombs on the city. The streets had erupted with violence and the electricity was shut off, reminding us that the Israelis controlled everything, from roads to water and phone lines. I felt overwhelmed. I had just made my way back to Ramallah from Nablus by crisscrossing a maze of roads that ran through the fragments of land that made up Palestine. I kept hoping for the situation to improve, but things just seemed to get worse and worse. All around the vehicle, I could see buildings that had been attacked and burned out cars. When a house is destroyed, whether because tanks and helicopters in Beit Jala fired shots at it, or because it was bulldozed in Hebron, so much more is lost than just the building. I had recently learned about one home that had been destroyed by a missile, killing the father and seriously wounding his family. Just like that, the family's future had been shattered, and the children have to grow up without the guidance of their father. I felt that this same violence had taken part of my parents from me, that this home destruction program had caused the stress that split them. I thought of what my grandfather's home in Lida had meant to him, how Uncle Faisal had worked hard to find a new home in Canada, how my mother and father had created a home for a growing family in Edmonton. A family home should be filled with pride as well as love, and the small objects that make memories, like family pictures, heirlooms, and images of the Kubat as-Sakra. These objects of memory would all be lost in the flames of Ramallah. The thought saddened me. The roads from Ramallah to Jerusalem were closed, but I found a car and driver to take me back to the city through the back roads. We were stopped at one checkpoint, and I was asked for my passport, but we were allowed through. Back in Jerusalem, at the Internet Cafe, I phoned my dad and my mom, relieved to be connecting with people I knew, people far away who were important to me. Both my parents begged me to come back, but all I could think as they spoke was, "I don't want to run away from war like the previous generation did. I wanted to stick it out." As I made my way back to Abu Dis, hitchhiking where I could find someone to take me part of the way, and walking the other stretches, I passed by soldiers without being asked for ID. This happened to me often, and at those times it troubled me that I was allowed to move around with ease while innocent old men and women were stopped and checked. The past few days had been filled with strange contrasts, from peacefully picking and eating grapes in my relative's garden in Hebron to the chilling shock of nasty encounters with soldiers on the road and nightly gunfire, no matter where I found myself. The gunshots would start at around 7 p.m., and people would begin to close their shops, though some remained open, not seeming especially concerned. "How can you be so cool when the firing is so close?" I asked shopkeepers time and again. And each time they'd say something like, "Today is nothing. You should have seen yesterday. For the last 2 weeks, every night there were helicopter machine gun attacks. It becomes the daily routine. People are used to it." A day or two after returning from Nablus, I sat at my cousin Reem's place watching TV. The news broadcaster reported that 8 Palestinians had been arrested in connection with the deaths of the 2 Israeli soldiers in Ramallah, but the report did not say how they were apprehended. It did not say anything about the 100 Palestinians who had been killed or about the hundreds who had been injured. Either there were no arrests made for crimes like these, or the soldiers were given light sentences. Court proceedings, it seemed, were only formalities. Arabs living outside the area of conflict, like many in Iraq, were donating food, supplies, and equipment to provide relief for Palestinians. They had sent a legion of doctors to nearby Jordan to help the wounded, who could make it out of occupied Palestine and across the border. As Reem and I were eating, I told her how I'd sometimes go to a Western fast food joint to soothe my homesickness. When I did that, every bite, every sip, every crunch reminded me of times in Canada, and I longed to be back there. I was craving fast food more than ever, I said to her. She understood. It was time for me to go home. I didn't want to lose my sanity here, and I sensed that it could happen. I told Reem a story about the time Uncle Faisal and his family had gone to the McDonald's at Northgate Center Mall. Someone called them fucking Pakis and told them to go back to your country. My Aunt Khadija had taken off her shoes and ready to use them as weapons to defend her family from these hoodlums. Reem laughed. When that incident occurred, Uncle Faisal had been in Canada for many years and was doing well. All his kids had been born there, but the honeymoon was over. They didn't look like white Canadians, so a Happy Meal experience meant being dished up a healthy dose of racism and bigotry on the side. And yet, even as I told the story, I knew that the racism we experienced in Canada was different, and that many Palestinians would never have the luxury of living in a country like Canada. As we spoke and watched television, I decided I could deal with being here for a bit longer. I had some strength, and I wanted to observe and record everything. For now, just having a burger and fries was a real treat. In those moments of homesickness, a taste of my Canadian culture meant dipping salty fries in puddles of ketchup.